And that was Phil Oakes. You probably recognize him. I hope you did. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, and it's 89.5 FM. And there's a great new book called American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. And the authors are Danny Haifong and Roberto Servent. And I believe we have Danny Haifong on the line. Are you there, Danny?
I am here. Good to be back with you.
It's great to be talking to you. You've got a great book, a very important one. I was really pleased. There's a lot of wonderful people. Glenn Ford wrote the afterword, and Jamu Baraka the foreword, and you've been praised by John Pilger, Michael Parenti, Dan Kovalik, Stephen Gowans. Pretty good company. Danny, I've got to say, by the way, particularly in reference to the Black Agenda Report, where I often read your material, you've just had a terrible loss, and in some ways it's connected. I want to connect it to your book because I saw that you spoke at the Left Forum and you mentioned Bruce Dixon, who has just passed away, and you brought in your discussion of him to how he had helped you apply the principles of your book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, about having to tackle imperialism to fight these fights. I don't mean to get way ahead of you, but talk about Bruce Dixon and your association.
Yeah, so it was really difficult to hear that Bruce Dixon passed the day before the Left Forum this weekend. At about 2:30 p.m. on, I think it was Friday. And I, Bruce Dixon was one of those irreplaceable aspects of the Black Agenda Report. His organizing expertise, his decades-long worth of experience in the Black Liberation Movement, to the Black Panther Party, the labor movement in Chicago, and also in his vast experience in the electoral arena, learning so much about how the Democratic Party really works, and his efforts to make the Green Party a dues-paying, organized political party of working people. All of those efforts were really a testament to his discipline and his commitment and service to the people. And losing him was very sudden. We knew he was sick, but we didn't know how much time he had. And he was someone who really didn't want to dabble in any of that. He was all in when it came to the struggle, and up until his last days, he was contributing to that struggle for social justice and social transformation. So it's a really difficult loss, but for me, his experience and his wisdom and his encouragement has been invaluable. Really, I came around Black Agenda Report in 2011 as a reader, and over the next 2 years, I went through a whole host of political experiences, and by the end of 2013, I was reaching out to him, as well as Glenn Ford, looking for some advice on how to answer some of these pressing questions about what do I do in this struggle, and ultimately, it was their advice that really motivated me to write for Black Agenda Report and to maintain the discipline that we believe is necessary to really challenge this system and to continue on this fight despite whatever path and pattern the forces of reaction are taking the left right now.
Yeah, and fundamental to that in this book, it strikes me, is that you have to make an honest and total picture of what the U.S. actually is. And as an empire and practicing imperialism, these are not words. As we watch the presidential debate, these are not words that are commonly raised. And those who might raise them, even slightly, or from some direction, are not listened to or blocked out. Right, and every social movement, I know you address Black Lives Matter, you address many of the others, have a problem when they come to this issue.
Yes, and that's a lot of what the book sought to talk about, analyze, and correct, because really what we need is political education that provides a corrective response to this problem that the ideologies of American exceptionalism and American innocence really present, which is a completely distorted understanding of what the United States is, what its social structure is, what its political economy is, and how the language, as you said, the language of imperialism is really not in the political discourse of the United States from the most radical of the left perspectives all the way to the far right. And even folks like Tulsi Gabbard, who bring up the issues of international warfare and foreign policy, are marginalized and minimized within the U.S. political structure. So what we really need then is, and that's what our work seeks to accomplish, is to debunk not only the myths, but also the ways in which these myths are really having an impact on the political behavior of the left. Because it is easy to say that the United States is not exceptional, the United States is not innocent, but it is harder to discuss how the very belief, this superiority, which is a white superiority that is so ingrained in the culture of the United States, much harder to say that this needs to be addressed within our political spaces and our organizations and our efforts to address the powers that be and to bring some restitution and some reparations. That's a really a buzzword right now in the political discourse, but to bring any repair, to bring any sort of condition of transformation in this country is going to take a whole lot of rectification with this reality.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you raised there's that expression. By the way, well, on imperialism, there was a time, it is very striking, there was an attempt when the U.S. really went overboard and decided they were going to go into the Philippines and take over Puerto Rico and Cuba. And there actually were people, Mark Twain was one, I think William James another, and very prominent, who said, we should not become imperialists. They were drowned out, literally and figuratively, in the case of the Philippines, in blood. But that debate happened a bit, but I don't believe it's ever really been debated by any major public figure since. Perhaps during the Vietnam War, I suppose that was possible.
Yeah, a lot of the debate about this question has had to come from, in the book, we talk about the internationalism of the black political movement in the United States and how really that is the biggest example of what the conversation about imperialism has looked like. And that for the most part, when grassroots efforts have sought to address the question of imperialism, both in its domestic manifestations, whether we're talking about the oppression of black people in the United States or the genocide of indigenous people, or the fact that finance capital has run roughshod over the conditions of working people, or we're talking about the endless war that the United States wages abroad, any efforts that have been undertaken to address those things in their totality, which has largely been from the black American community in the United States, that those efforts have been met with the most harsh and severe forms of repression. And we dedicate a whole chapter to that history in chapter 9 of the book, where we talk about the myth of free speech in the United States and how even the most leftist of liberals who talk about the sanctity of free speech in the form of ensuring that everyone can, you know, say what they want and do what they want as long as it's within the bounds of acceptability. We see that if we're not looking at who and what is exactly enforcing these really bourgeois individual rights, we're ultimately just going to be taking down a path of futility and bankruptcy, where we can't even address the power structure when we're so concerned with these so-called individual rights. And so we need to look at how people themselves have been ultimately the only actors in history and the only ones that can challenge imperialism. But at this time, that that phrase, that very term, is outside of the political discourse because there is such a consensus on the need for the United States to have a military that defends the so-called freedoms and rights of the people here. And that's really the big issue, because people are tired of war in the United States, but there really is no movement that is challenging whether the U.S. really requires such a massive national security state that it does have. There's very few who are questioning that at a political level, maybe at an individual level.
Yeah. Well, your writing is, in your writing, and I know that I've seen your, also your Twitter account, is pointing out that if the population is permitted to hear these words, they do actually respond. I mean, it's the whatever, you know, the shortcomings or limitations of the approach of Bernie Sanders, it clearly, I'd say the echo was louder than the voice. And in the case of Tulsi Gabbard, many people, and particularly veterans, people who've been in the U.S. military, said, but tell it like it is. That's a, you know, there is, if they were given the microphone, which they're not going to be, there would, it's clear there's an audience.
Yes, definitely. That's also why we wrote this book, because we felt like there was an audience for people in the United States, especially in the wake of Sanders' phenomenon, especially in the post-Obama period, where the Obama administration was able to get away with so much and neutralize much of the left in remaining quiet and silent about the crimes of the U.S. empire. We have now a situation where the Trump administration, the chaos and the political order in the United States, is opening up opportunities. A lot of people see the Trump administration as a boogeyman, a Russian threat, all of this nonsense. But what that is really missing is an analysis of the opportunities that really exist when the ruling class is at each other's throats and really unsure about how they can decide who is going to manage this system right now. And so this book really seeks to ensure that people in the struggle have a tool for political education that can challenge these myths and also present the analysis of what imperialism is and how the United States is an imperialist system, how it does have a ruling class, that it has always been shaped by class struggle, and that the myths of American exceptionalism and innocence, this idea that the U.S. is a force for good in the world, and the idea that the United States is always a victim and thus can wreak havoc domestically and abroad without any consequences. To be able to talk about that in our political spaces, in our organizing spaces, in our workplaces, you know, anywhere, is critically important right now when so many people in the United States are really ready for some kind of change. They're looking at the word socialism. They're looking at these policies like the Green New Deal. They're looking at Medicare for All. But really, it's a lot of looking, because at the end of the day, we see that the endless war on austerity that the United States wages on a bipartisan basis does not budge just because people want something.
That has been, certainly, there's a couple of traps they've created. One is the responsibility to protect in the name of human rights around the globe, and then the other, this trap of I've lost the track. But let's go back to the one that this thing of that they have to protect people. Terrorism. Yeah, the idea that we're fighting terrorism, but in the case of Syria, Syria is fighting terrorism. And the U.S. is creating it. I mean, if you wanted, obviously terrorism could be ended very quickly in Syria if we would cooperate with the government of Syria against people who are avowedly terrorists.
Right. And the danger of American exceptionalism and American innocence and all of this is the ability for the U.S. corporate state and corporate media and military industrial complex to convince many people in the United States that Bashar al-Assad and the government of Syria is indeed the enemy and is indeed the dictator, the butcher, the fascist. We even have some publications who claim the Progressive call Bashar al-Assad a fascist when In fact, the United States has been arming groups in that region and supporting countries that arm groups in that region, which really do hold fascistic-like ideologies and plans for the region to create these ethno-religious Balkanized states. And we have to really push back against that because at the end of the day, there is no appetite for war in the United States. But the United States wages war in a way now where it can both presume itself to be an innocent bystander. It always talks about how any intervention that it does abroad is for humanitarian purposes. And we saw what that produced in a nation like Libya. And so the dangers of humanitarian intervention are probably graver than any other period, because at this point we're in a real serious situation where the more that this narrative of humanitarian interventionism and imperialism is able to survive, the more likely we are going to get to a point where Russia and China become the primary target of humanitarian interventionism. That's why they talk about Russia's so-called human rights abuses and China's so-called human rights abuses from the mouthpieces of usually intelligence analysts or exiles from those countries, oligarchs from those countries that have since made careers looking to demonize them. We really have to pause and ask ourselves, us in the United States and in the Western world broadly, what do we stand to benefit from any involvement in these things, whether they're being framed as humanitarian causes or whether they're being framed as straight-up wars for the sake of U.S. dominance. Ultimately, the interests are the same regardless, but humanitarian interventionism allows the United States to pose as a good actor and a civilized actor, and it really reinforces this white man's burden ideology that the United States has been marching with since its foundation.
Sorting out the evildoers. And it's Danny Haifong we're speaking to, and the book, by the way, please get this book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. I was really glad to see that at the forum, the Left Forum in New York, you tackled the issue or brought up the fact that there's a mischaracterization. Not only does America lie about its own history, but there's also a problem in comprehending what China is and what they've accomplished and how there's really no basis for any adversarial treatment. I thought, as I was reading your book, that LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, said that he wanted to have, because America needed it badly, a war on poverty. And so under his administration, they tried to solve the issue of poverty in America. Now, all these years later, that's just forgotten. That's just a heap of dust. And they didn't solve the war. They lost the war on poverty. And you describe a China that also said, we're going to have a war on poverty. And they won it or are winning it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, China is a critical example. And at the Left Forum, I talked about China as the most definitive example of what an anti-imperialist movement looks like today. And many people might say, well, China made mistakes here, China made mistakes there. But when we actually look at the definition of what imperialism is, it's not just war. Imperialism is not just a struggle against war. Anti-imperialism is a struggle against the forces that create the need for endless war. And Lenin called those forces basically finance capital, the rule of the cartels and the monopolies and the banks. And that's what we have at this stage of capitalism. It's the, some people call it the latest stage. I call it the highest stage of imperialism, where the consolidation of finance capital is at its highest point. And that's why endless war is so important to the United States. And China, on the other hand, has done the complete opposite. While allowing market penetration into China with strict controls and planned economic governance under the leadership of the Communist Party, what we've seen in China is an astronomical decrease in poverty, whereby all of the poverty reduction in the world over the last three decades has been as a result of China's effort to reduce its own poverty.
It's in the hundreds of millions, right?
Right. 800 million since 1970.
Lifted out of poverty.
Lifted out of poverty. And some will
say, called the people's government. There's a logic there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that includes a real wage increase for the bottom half of the population, but 401%. And if we compare that to what's happened in the United States and the West, and just take the United States, where wages have been stagnant or declining since, if compared to inflation since 1978, we see a stark contrast. And that's really the reason why China is so much of a threat to the United States. It's not that China commits human rights violations, because whenever we look at who is accusing China of these things, we never find verifiable sources coming from them. But it's because China's economic model is seeking to go global. It has gone global already, but it is seeking to even intensify that trend with efforts like the New Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road initiative, where trillions of dollars will be spent to do the exact same thing that China has been able to accomplish within its own borders, which is the reduction of poverty, the increase in development, and the ability for underdeveloped nations that have been ravaged by imperialism and colonialism to be able to chart an independent path from the United States and the West. And that is very scary for that, for the United States.
Yeah, and by the way, we got a taste of that in Canada. Now the taste is turning a bit bitter, but Huawei came here and is here and has contributed mightily. It's been building things. They've been supporting universities, particularly research and study, in order to reach this 5G, whatever that means, platform. And Trump says we can't do that anymore. He says, no, you're going to have to stop. And why? Well, because he says so.
Exactly. And the United States is in decline, and its Western partners are following the United States.
Aren't we going to make this a cult of backwardness? Won't the ultimate be, if Trump and Trudeau continue down this road, we're really going to become rather backward.
Right, and that's been a process that's been occurring, because the whole age of neoliberalism and the whole age of endless war and austerity has been a march to the bottom, a race to the bottom, and that includes the loss of the ability for the United States to really compete on the global stage with China because of China's command economy, which is socialist, contrary to what a lot of people think. It does have control, state control over the commanding heights of the economy, much different from Scandinavian models. And we see how that is such a threat to the United States, who all it can accomplish and its Western partners can accomplish is increasing its profits for investors through not production, but through debt and through finance and through financialization. And that's because investors have created such an environment of misery whereby investments in production are seen as themselves risky. So now the less risky option is to ensure that the so-called fiat economy, the so-called economy based on finance, is the only thing that the United States is really concerned with, and China is going to run away with not only becoming the largest economy in the world, but also the most influential one. And that is why we see so much disdain and animosity from the United States towards the People's Republic.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, now with 1 minute to go, I better ask something that I meant to get it to earlier. But last week on this show, we talked to Ishmael Reed. He has been waging a war against this so-called musical Hamilton. And I noticed you took the subject up, and you said it's a monument to white supremacy, which, by the way, I'm sure he takes his hat off when he hears that. But just mention, if you would, what you think of Hamilton.
Sure. So our analysis in the book, in our chapter about the real monuments to white supremacy, we were talking about the taking down of statues all over the country when it came to the Confederacy. This happened around 2017 with some unfortunate incidents that occurred in Charlottesville, North Carolina, in that time of August 2017. But we were really talking about how U.S. culture is really steeped in white supremacy. and that Hamilton represents a real seductive form of that, whereby this whole notion of inclusion has been taken to such an extreme degree where the founding fathers, such as Alexander Hamilton and others, who were either implicated or directly practicing the enslavement of Africans, now can be played by black actors, and that somehow makes this history progressive. Yes, it makes it progressive, it makes it okay, it makes it something that even the creator of Hamilton himself said was something to be proud of, that we could leave the cultural baggage about the founding fathers at the door when we watch Hamilton. When in fact, the afterlives of slavery live on into today, we see how the black American population represents such a large percentage, almost 40% of the U.S.'s prison population, and that is at 2.2 million at this point. And we see how black wealth in the United States is becoming so robbed and looted by the forces of capital that we are in a situation where in 2053, black wealth may be zero. So we really can't leave the cultural baggage about the founding fathers at the door, as Hamilton's creator claims, because, in fact, that baggage continues to suffocate and sit on top of the throats of black people in the United States. So multiculturalism, diversity, all of this is a huge theme in our book, and we seek to debunk it for the purposes of having a real genuine political conversation about its horrific effect on our political consciousness.
Terrific. Hey, Danny Haifong, author of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, People's History. Hey, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Okay. This is Taylor Report. We've got to thank Braden and Phil Conlon, and we'll see you next week.